Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast, along with Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show, or even just a favorite fish species, please go check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast fan shop hosted by Teespring. We can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, face masks, and more. Look for the link in the show description. Today, I'm talking to two amazing scientists who I had the pleasure of going to school with during my PhD. Both are working as fisheries scientists in the Caribbean, and I'm excited for them to share their experience in the region. I invited them to the podcast today because we often wonder about what kinds of jobs are available to people once they get a higher degree in fisheries or marine science. All three of us have PhDs from the same place, the University of South Florida's College of Marine Science, but the three of us actually have very different jobs, and I'm excited for these guys to share their journeys with you. Dr. Snai Habtis holds a PhD from the University of South Florida in College of Marine Science. He is currently a research assistant professor of biological oceanography at the University of the Virgin Islands. His research focuses on the fields of fisheries, oceanography, and zooplankton ecology. He's interested in the physical processes and environmental variability in coastal and pelagic ecosystems surrounding the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, and determining how these factors affect the abundance and distribution of marine organisms. Dr. Orion Sadiq also holds a PhD from the University of South Florida's College of Marine Science. He is currently a science and policy officer at a major NGO in the U.S. Caribbean. His current work strives to conserve ocean resources and coastal habitats, promote sustainable fishing practices, and transition to an ecosystem-based approach to fisheries management in the U.S. Caribbean. Welcome to the podcast, Snai and Ori. I'm so excited to get to interview both of you today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Great to be here.
So I usually like to hear from people sort of about their origin story and what got you hooked on the ocean or fisheries in the first place. Do you have an initial memory of what really grabbed your attention about the ocean, Snai?
I mean, I think for me, I was born and raised on St. Thomas. And so, you know, I grew up on a small island surrounded by open ocean, really, and the Caribbean Sea. And so I was, you know, I've always had an interest just either, you know, scuba diving or snorkeling in the nearshore waters and the diverse ecosystems that surround the USVI. And so that always had a draw, but I never really knew that that was a career path that I could follow. I think, you know, in high school, I was fortunate enough to have a tropical ecology class that really kind of opened my eyes to the research that can actually be done in the marine environment. I think up until that point, I had only thought of science as being something that you could do related to medicine. And so, you know, that was really where I thought I was going. I knew I wanted to do research. I've always liked research. And I knew I wanted to do something related to science, but I had no idea that a lot of my other passions related to diving, surfing, and fishing around the USVI could influence the career path that I went on. And so I think that was even tangled up until I got out of undergrad, right? I really, you know, I started doing pre-med, and then I played rugby for UNC, which is where I did my undergrad, and there were a couple of teammates who were doing an environmental sciences degree, and they were like, this one guy, Simon, he's British, he was like, mate, you're miserable doing these classes. Why don't you think of taking some of these upper level courses in environmental science? I think, you know, from our conversations, you would really enjoy them. And so I did, and that kind of opened my eyes. And I switched majors and did environmental sciences with a minor in marine sciences, and then worked for about a year and at their Marine Institute down in Morehead City. And that was where I really got introduced to doing applied and fisheries work, because I worked on a project that looked at clam kicking in the Sounds of North Carolina. That kind of is what hooked me.
Tell me what clam kicking is.
That's a great question. I always forget to explain that. I don't think anyone really knows about it except for fishermen in North Carolina. So I'm not even sure if they still practice it there, but it was a type of harvesting technique where they pump the back of their boats, and these are like wide draft shallow water boats because they're running in these sandy shoals in North Carolina. And so they pump bilge water essentially to the stern to get the the back of the boat lower so they can drag a cage across the sandy bottom. And so if it's done in like seagrass areas, it can be really destructive. But if you do it in these sandy shoals, it's a fine harvesting practice for collecting clams. And so that's what some of the research was looking at, was understanding its effect in different habitats and seeing if there are essentially setting up closed areas and open areas for these fishermen to practice the technique.
I was totally imagining these guys like going out in waders and like literally like kicking for clams.
People do that too. But you take a basically, they have kind of a modified basket dip net with these like prongs on the front of it. So okay. You kind of drag it through the sand, doing like an undulating bouncing motion to kind of pick up the clams into the baskets, which is fun. Yeah. Unless you're doing it for like, you know, 12 hours a day, which is part of what I was doing when I was working there.
That sounds
rough. But you get, you know, like that's the thing about, you know, doing field research is you get out into places that people don't normally get to go on a regular basis in nature. You know, I think for me, the first time I ever got to take a research cruise and go out into the middle of the ocean, you know, there's nothing around. Like you don't see land, you rarely see other boats. And for me, that's home. I love it out there. You know, I think that's what really got me hooked on doing oceanography, I think, was my first research cruise. But I've been fortunate to have there are a lot of times where I could have kind of gotten off the pathway to being a professor or you know, getting my PhD in marine sciences. And I was lucky enough to have really good mentors through programs like MSPhDs, which is Minorities Striving to Pursue Higher Degrees of Success in Earth System Sciences. They really kept me on track and were like, no, you know, I think you really should keep going. And I got exposed to a lot of interesting research and good mentors that helped keep me on track to be where I am now. It wasn't a straight path, I can tell you that.
Rarely is. Rarely yeah. is. I really appreciate you sharing about the clam kicking.
Not a problem.
Definitely a fisher I'd never heard of.
Yeah. I mean, I can honestly say I haven't really done much work on that since I was working right after undergrad, but it was an interesting experience, you know.
Ori, what is one of your first memories of really like just being hooked on the ocean?
Yeah, it's funny actually. Very different from Sinai. I grew up in Southern California in Los Angeles, so a major city, but a major city that has nice weather and beaches and is always tied to the ocean in some way. So, you know, I grew up in the school system there. We went on like field trips to, you know, little labs that were doing studies and things like that. I actually have a very distinct memory of one of those massive sea slugs that they get in Southern California. I forgot the name. I think it's called a sea hare.
Yeah. Yep. Just this, yes, they are enormous.
Right. It's like 2 foot long slug.
And it's, you know, literally the size of a rabbit.
Right. And that sticks out as, you know, an 8-year-old seeing that in a tank and being able to touch it and that sort of thing. So I guess where Sinai said, you know, he never really knew it was career path, I actually always knew it was a career path, and it was always kind of in the background for me. So I think that I kind of diverged every now and again, but then always came back to it. And so, you know, you ask about distinct memories. I have a distinct memory talking to my older brother before I went to college. And obviously being the responsible older brother type, you know, he's asking me, what do you think you're going to do? What are you going to major in and all this? And I said, well, you know, I thought maybe marine biology. Now, mind you, I was going to Austin, Texas. So I was going to the middle of like the middle, right? No ocean around. And I said, yeah, I'm thinking about marine biology. And I just remember him being like, my little brother, the marine biologist. Yeah, that's cool. And I was like, yeah, you know what? That is cool. And so that's kind of, that's where I was at. I mean, it was always kind of there in the background. And then as I went on with the schooling, you know, I started out liberal arts undecided in college. And I took all sorts of classes and tried to kind of expand my horizons. and ended up just always coming back to what interests me, which was marine sciences. After undergrad, I guess I just viewed it as a degree. And then after undergrad, I went and really started going on some really cool field research opportunities, kind of like Sinai said, you know, where he feels at home is out on the open ocean. I don't know that I'd go so far as to say the open ocean for me, but definitely the beach is where I feel at home. And so I was involved in some projects looking at, you know, promoting marine conservation and working with volunteers to monitor coral reefs. And I did that work in Costa Rica and in Mexico. And I had some time traveling around the Caribbean, kind of doing the same thing, just, you know, a lot of outreach in marine sciences and that sort of thing. And I think I've just always been drawn back to it more than anything. And to be honest, I don't really see a different way that I could have gone. It just seems like it would have always been, you know, what I came back to.
And so you said that you've worked all over the Caribbean and you've spent quite a bit of time now in Puerto Rico. Do you think that there's particular challenges to working in sort of a multilingual environment?
That's a great question. I think there's two sides to that. One is becoming fluent in the second language. That's obviously a challenge, but I imagine that's a challenge in any field. The difficulties I've seen have been more to do with the confusion and kind of the exact meaning of words. So the way my brain operates is that I think in English and then I translate to Spanish, and that's problematic for its own reasons, but there's certain words that just have, they kind of mean the same thing, but they're different. So I'll give you an example. The word tranquilo, right? Like tranquil, you know, it means tranquil, right? In English, but they use it here much more in like, hey, just chill out, right? Like tranquilo. But like, if you say that to somebody in English, you say, hey, just be tranquil. They look at you like you're trying to like shoot them with a dart or something, right? And then to kind of take it to the fisheries world, you know, if you want to talk about like you're going to go spear fishing and you're going to use a spear, that sounds pretty, you know, benign. It's not a big deal. If I told you I was going to go spear fishing with a harpoon, you know, you might think, you might look at me funny, right? You might think I'm going whaling or something. But when you say it in Spanish, it's harpón. And so, you know, those kind of exact meanings are always a little tricky for me. And then, of course, there's the same old problem as common names of organisms in English, you know, and you get that in Spanish, too. And so for me, I'm not only translating, let's say, you know, what is a Nassau grouper, you know, Epinaphilus striatus, right? Like, I have to also think, okay, what do they call it here versus what do they call it in, you know, potentially in Florida when they're speaking in Spanish? And what do they call it in, you know, South America? And so it's that, you know, that's just, I mean, I think that goes with the territory of the whole common names thing.
Yeah, and local, yeah, like the official common name versus like the local name. And
correct. And versus what do the old time fishermen call it, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Sinai, your work is at UVI as a research professor. Are you teaching classes, have graduate students, just focusing on research?
All three, Julie. I teach classes, I have graduate students, and I do research. Yeah. I mean, I think professors are always busy. You're merging a lot of different worlds within the infrastructure of a university. So I think a lot of times what you define the career as are the three things that you mentioned. There's also a fourth aspect of it, which is service, meaning both to the university and your community. So I kind of try and juggle all four of those things and weave those into like a single aspect of being a professor at the university. So I do teach. I currently teach a course in the master's for marine and environmental sciences program here at UVI, and it's research methodologies and tools. And the class is really meant to be kind of an intro biometry class where we are teaching students how to use statistics and design field studies to aid them in their research. So it's, you know, basic methodologies of ecological theory and statistical analysis and experimental design. But we also tie that to beginner statistical programming in R, because we feel that those are, you know, necessary skills for our students going forward. And they take two semesters of a course like this. The first is, you know, kind of intro univariate statistics. The second semester is kind of intro multivariate statistics. And then I have two master's students at the present time, and I'm likely going to be looking for two or three more in the upcoming year to work on a couple of projects. One master's student, Max Cohen, is working on understanding the environmental cues for spawning in yellowfin grouper. So we have a time series of a couple years of tagged yellowfin movement data at the Grumonic Bank, which is a closed area or a seasonally closed area to protect spawning aggregation. So yellowfin grouper, one of these large coral reef fish that are, you know, that used to be ubiquitous in the Caribbean, but due to heavy fishing pressure at these spawning sites, which they go to the same place every year for reproduction, which is what I mean by spawning. And so they were hit hard in the late 70s and early 80s, and the populations have really seen sharp declines, actually probably even earlier than that. And so what we're trying to do is understand if there are environmental cues based on equipment that we've had out at this site where we know they spawn. So we have a 3 or 4 year time, actually we have an 8 year time series of environmental data and then 2 to 3 years of movement data from these spawn fish. So we're trying to look at how environmental cues may influence either their movement behaviors or spawning behaviors. So that's what he's doing. And I have another student who's working on an interesting project. We have a national research traineeship here from NSF that's looking at the food, energy, water systems nexus. And this student is trying to understand if there are ways of integrating things like solar, being the energy part, into the development of containerized aquaculture labs for a burgeoning kind of scallop aquaculture project that I have going here at the university.
Wow. Those are really different.
Extremely different. Right? I think right now at UVI, I'm kind of the only biological oceanographer, kind of. We have a lot of people that have been trained at marine science institutions, but their work follows a more marine biology pathway rather than an oceanography pathway. My work spans a lot of different areas. So I do a lot of fisheries oceanography, which is my traditional discipline and the area that I feel most comfortable doing research. But I have a lot of colleagues and partners like Ori, who we're talking to today, from past research and from graduate education that reach out to me because they know I'm here in the Virgin Islands now. And there's a lot of burgeoning work that's ongoing. So my time gets split amongst a lot of really interesting research applications and projects down here. And then I think I talked a little bit about my teaching, my research. Oh, and then service. So, you know, part of being a professor is actually working towards maintaining both the infrastructure of your university, but I like to think also the infrastructure of your community. And so you sit on a lot of committees and that can seem boring, but what it really does is helps you keep track of what's going on with other colleagues that may be in other departments across the university and find ways to coordinate on things that help benefit the university. So that's what I do. But I also do that within the community, as Ori knows, and I think we'll probably talk a little bit later in the podcast about projects that we work on together, both sit on some panels and committees for the Caribbean Fisheries Management Council, which is the regional fishery association for the U.S. Caribbean. And so that's part of working within your region or your community towards things that help benefit science and the scientific infrastructure that keeps things going in the territories. I'm on a 12-month appointment, and I essentially fill that time, meaning I either write grants or I teach courses to fill that time. And there's no requirement for a set number to do either, right? So I can either, you know, I could be 12 months of teaching if I find enough courses that are interesting for me to teach, or I can do 12 months of research, but I like to do a mix of both so that I can, you know, keep you know, you always want to be working with the students in some capacity beyond just the ones, the students that you're mentoring that are doing a master's with you. So I try to kind of do both every year. Teaching faculty, on the other hand, at UVI have a set number of courses that they have to teach every year. And so it kind of limits their ability to do research. I think there are benefits to both. At UVI currently, we don't, well, within my program anyway, we don't really have a tenure track for strictly research faculty, which I think is common in a lot of other institutions as well. There is a bit of a lack of safety net. And there's also, especially for early career faculty like myself that is coming in to build a program, you know, there's been an oceanography program at UVI for a while, but not specifically in the vein of research that I do. And there is a need, you know, especially after being hit by hurricanes Irma and Maria, to redo a lot and rebuild a lot of the infrastructure and also build on that infrastructure, both human and physical. And if you're doing that and spending your time on that, you're not as easily able to work on research that would allow you to publish quickly. So there is a bit of a lack of safety net associated with the kind of work you're doing, particularly if there isn't a tenure track. I'm from the Virgin Islands. I've always wanted to come back and be able to do the type of research that I find interesting, because there is a lot of opportunity for scientific discovery, I feel, in the U.S. Caribbean. To really achieve that, we're going to need to ramp up the type of infrastructure that's available, make it easy for other, you know, scientists to come down and work with us and build strong collaborative partnerships, which, you know, can be hard given the physical distance. We're you know, like the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico are a ways away from the continental U.S., where most of the scientific infrastructure for marine science and for oceanography and for fisheries are.
Yeah.
So like for me, if, you know, I want to do a research cruise, I got to wait at least, you know, 7 days for a vessel to come down, you know, from either Charleston or from Miami. And oftentimes that type of journey on fleets that are kind of getting older can create downtime when they get here due to problems with the ship, you know. So we, you know, I really, what I see as a need for the U.S. Caribbean is to create some sort of coastal, at least, research vessel that can greatly move the type of research we do here in oceanography forward. But that takes time, right? That takes a lot of planning, writing infrastructure grants, and you can sometimes be punished career-wise if you're solely focused on doing that kind of work rather than getting a lot of papers out on interesting and innovative discoveries.
So switching gears into the NGO world, Ori, can you give me a little bit of a summary of what your job entails?
Yeah, so we come at it from, you know, a very different angle than Sinai. My job is a lot about promoting the type of work that Sinai does and promoting the best available science and pursuing advocacy in the name of the best available science. So certain things that I believe in, for example, are promoting EBFM strategies, ecosystem-based fishery management strategies. The way that fisheries typically operate is on a single species model. But to me, it makes a lot more sense to focus on, you know, ecosystem-based science, ecosystem-based strategies. When you're considering how much you can fish a certain stock, right, it makes sense to take into account what fish that fish is eating or who is eating that fish, right? What are other factors on the stock other than fishing? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the single species approaches, while they allow for those constants in their equations, they don't necessarily model the entire system nor, you know, draw strategies that apply to the entire system. And so that's something that I believe in strongly, is promoting kind of ecosystem-based fishery management strategies. And along with that, in this region in particular, we're dealing with a coral reef fishery, which is pretty different than temperate reefs. When you go and you look at some of the stuff that they deal with in even, you know, some of the colder regions, not necessarily Florida, but more like, you know, New England, their fishery has many fewer species than ours. So we have a lot of fishermen that are relatively indiscriminate in what they're targeting. And so they'll put a fish strap down and maybe within a single haul,
they'll get dozens of different species. And so when you're talking about that, it really makes sense to be looking at the habitat as a whole, as the ecosystem as a whole. And then within that, you know, in my opinion, the way that management would be sustainable and effective would be to promote more of these kind of spatial management schemes towards fishery management. And that's something that I believe in strongly and I'm trying to promote. And from what I've seen, the best available science suggests that that is the approach moving forward. And that's how we should be approaching our fisheries.
Yeah, and just a couple months ago, you published in the Fisheries magazine to that effect.
Right. So, I recently published with co-authors in Fisheries. The title of the paper, Using Opportunistic Data Sets to Infer Spatial Management Strategies of Local Fisheries in the U.S. Caribbean Region. A little bit of background on that is that the Caribbean Fishery Management Council, which Sanai alluded to earlier, decided recently to transition from a regional approach to fisheries management to island-based schemes. So the U.S. Caribbean region entails Puerto Rico, St. Thomas, St. John, and St. Croix. St. Thomas and St. John are on the same platform, and so they consider that kind of one island, one fishery. So instead of now having a regional fishery management plan, the council developed three individual island-based fishery management plans, one for Puerto Rico, one for St. Croix, and one for St. Thomas, St. John. In the wake of them doing that, my co-authors and I decided to use what we called opportunistic data sets, which were basically just data sets that were publicly available. So we didn't go out and collect new data. We used the data that already existed. They were all fishery independent monitoring data sets, and they were primarily NOAA-derived data sets, so federally funded. They were mostly divers going down and talking about the fish assemblage on the reef and describing that assemblage. And so we used those data sets to kind of analyze the decision that was made by the Caribbean Fishery Management Council to split their fishery management plans into the island-based units. I don't want to ruin the ending because I know that everybody's going to run out and download the paper and read it right now, but spoiler alert, they did the right thing. And the way that we looked at that was basically, you know, do the fish communities differ among the three islands? Mm-hmm. And what we found was that, in fact, they did. And they actually, you know, they differ on a smaller scale than just the three islands. And I think that in an island system, kind of any fisherman will tell you this, you know, if you're talking to a fisherman in Puerto Rico, they're going to tell you, there's a completely different ecosystem on the north coast of the island than there is on the south coast of the island. And what comes with that are completely different fish assemblages. I talked to a fisherman on the east coast, actually, of Puerto Rico, who said that he thinks that fishery management should occur at the watershed level. So kind of each river, each estuary system should have its own management plan. And I can't say I disagree with him. The science would definitely back it. However, you know, reality is a different story.
Yeah.
It just takes insane amount of resources that are just unavailable. But what we're, you know, the kind of the larger picture is that fish communities do differ on much smaller spatial scales than I think people choose to recognize. And the smaller we can hone in on that, I think it makes more sense. And you look at places like Florida, and they've recognized this to a certain degree, right? You don't manage all the Florida fisheries the same. I mean, there's the Gulf fishery, and then there's the Atlantic fishery in a lot of cases.
Right. Yeah. And in a lot of inshore species here, actually, red right. drum, snook, spotted sea trout, that stuff, they're divided into even more areas. Mm-hmm. The panhandle is separate from, you know, the Keys. Obviously, they just have wildly different is really important ecologically, but I think it does cause some amount of confusion within the public. So it is a tough balancing act.
Yeah, exactly. And Florida, I mean, you know, let's be honest here. Florida is much bigger than Puerto Rico, and Puerto Rico is much bigger than each of the Virgin Islands. But I think it all boils down to, you know, what spatial scale you're choosing to manage at. And I think that you have the ability to go to very fine spatial scales. And the question is just kind of the risk reward, right? What are the trade-offs in doing that? And so anyway, the paper just kind of looked at some of that and noted these differences and tried to provide a bit of a model for how people could try to look at this thing in the future. Specifically, you know, we really wanted to hammer home the idea of using these opportunistic data sets. You know, I think all three of us have worked at some point with government agencies and on some of these monitoring where we go out and, you know, we have years and years worth of monitoring data. And unfortunately, I think a lot of times that stuff just gets pushed to the side or gets used for a single purpose. Mm-hmm. And the truth is there's so much more that can be derived from each of these data sets.
So you guys have both alluded a little bit to working together within the Caribbean Fishery Management Council. What other kinds of projects are you collaborating on?
I'll let Sanai answer this one. I'll give him a little tee up. We both participate on the Ecosystem-Based Fishery Management Technical Advisory Panel to the Caribbean Fishery Management Council, and we are charged with developing something called the Fishery Ecosystem Plan. Sanai is the chair of that council, and I'll let him tell you all about it.
No, I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head there, Ori. There are a couple of groups within the U.S. Caribbean that have been working on trying to get a lot of these data sets that Ori was previously talking about and use those to help inform ecosystems-based fisheries management on an island-based scale that he was talking about, meaning rather than looking at the U.S. Caribbean as a single managed region, create fishery ecosystems plan to help inform fisheries management on an island, St. Thomas, St. John, St. Croix, and Puerto Rican level. We are right now, as a group, and there are eight people who span a lot of different disciplines, some of us from the academic side, others from the policy side, like Ori, and some from the government, both regional and federal agencies, all working on this effort to help inform the Caribbean Fisheries Management Council, basically create a guiding framework for how we can use ecosystems information and ecosystems modeling to inform fisheries management decision support systems in the U.S. Caribbean. And if that's too much jargon, I apologize. Just be thankful I didn't use acronyms, which we can get prone to do.
No, man. Yeah, that is, that's a lot. And it's really cool to be able to bring all those things together. I know, so my current job, I actually work with the Fishery Dependent Monitoring Program at Florida Fish and Wildlife right now. And a part of my job is actually to figure out what all data sets we have just within FDM and figure out how to get those data sets out into the world in, you know, in some sort of published format and what kind of projects, what kind of papers they can be used for. So it is a monumental task to be able to try to, you know, find and incorporate all of these different data sets from different entities and different time spans and everything else.
So. And one thing, Julie, I'd like to add to that is just, I think sometimes it just takes looking at it from a different angle. Hmm. You know, I mean, sometimes it's just the data set was developed with a certain objective in mind. And sometimes when you come at it from a different angle, and try and say, well, they did collect all these other data. Maybe we could use that stuff to kind of inform, you know, a different question.
I think just also to add again, I think too, what we have to realize is oftentimes the people that have designed these monitoring efforts, they were funded in part to do that job, meaning to collect that data. And it's often hard to find the resources necessary to do other things with it that weren't a vision in, you know, when these programs were created 5 to 10 to 15 years ago. And so it's important, you know, this is one of the benefits of having a person like Ori who works for an NGO who is, you know, trying to coordinate a lot of these efforts and promote a lot of these efforts to do different things with the data, you know, and he helps rope in people like myself who are working with this data for different reasons to look at it in a broader context and see how it can be used for things like ecosystem-based modeling to inform fisheries management.
Sanai, when you say rope in, you mean gave you the opportunity, right?
that was in the most positive light, Ori. Absolutely. By roped, I mean you went out there and handed me a rope as a friend to pull me aboard the ship to do the work that we're working on now.
Perfect.
All in the spirit of collaboration.
Diving off of that idea, preparing for this interview, I realized that all three of us have worked both sort of at the edges of marine fisheries research, pioneering new techniques or new ways of looking at data, new physical techniques like non-lethal aging or chemical archives or using novel data sources, and also sort of in the trenches in terms of fisheries monitoring, routine stock assessments, and that sort of thing. Sanai, which one's your favorite?
I mean, I would say for me, I love methodology, right? So like my first paper for my dissertation was a methodology paper. And that was when I was working with the bluefin tuna decision support system. So we were looking at trying to do modeling for identifying spawning habitat for Atlantic bluefin tuna in the Gulf of Mexico. And by being able to look at this larger data set and incorporating some new net sampling techniques, we were able to see that it wasn't just spatially that it was important to focus on, but also looking at depth in the water column, you know. And so I think those kind of things really interest me, is creating innovations in sampling on things that we've done for 15 or 20 years. But that's getting harder and harder for me, I think, to work on. You know, I do still do a lot of network, but writing a grant to say that you're going to create a new sampling technique for collecting larval fish isn't as sexy or as innovative anymore. But those are the things that really do capture a lot of my attention. I think we spawned a lot of, and I mean we as fisheries and scientific researchers in general, spawned a lot of new net sampling methodologies, you know, over the last 50 years. So I think people have gotten a little tired of that. But those are the things that really interest me, using new data sources, I think, and trying to find new ways of collecting the data better have always really drawn my interest in the applied form of fisheries research.
Ori, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at my publication record, it's actually, I probably should have just said what Sanai said. A lot of, you know, methodology stuff. But I would bring it out a little bit more. I'd take the 30,000 foot view a little bit more. What drives me as a scientist, you know, is discovery. I get so excited by, you know, discovery, whatever that form is. And so sometimes that's a matter of, you know, you run all your samples in a lab and you get all the data back and you're looking at it on a computer screen thinking to yourself, I know this works. I just have to figure out how. Mm-hmm. And then when you discover how it works, it's like, I mean, just a fantastic feeling, you know? I think that, you know, but then that also applies, I mean, I've been on, I don't know how many fishery monitoring dives, you know, going down, doing a transect or going down, doing a cylinder. And I mean, at this point, I think I've seen almost every fish in the book. And so when I see a new one, or if I see a juvenile of something I've never seen, you know, it's, to me, it's a new discovery. And it's, I get that same feeling, that same just real excited, you know, and I think that that's really what drives.
Yeah, I always love a lot of times, especially being underwater, going back to the same places, because you're right, it just allows you to see that one new thing that you've never seen.
Right. Yeah. And it's funny, you go with a lot of, if you go diving with somebody, I also am a scuba, or I was a scuba instructor, and, you know, taking somebody who's never been underwater, and I'll see something, you know, that's pretty unexciting to look at maybe, but I've never seen it before. And I'll point it out to them and they're, you know, they're looking at me like I'm crazy, and they're looking at some fish I've seen 1,000 times, but it has pretty colors. Right. So I think that, yeah, I mean, there's so much to it. It's so exciting, and there's so much, you know, specifically with marine science, it's really probably when all of us were a little younger, you know, it's probably described, you've all heard the cliche, like, we know more about the surface of the moon than the bottom of the ocean kind of thing. So there's just so much more to discover. And there's so many more challenges associated with the marine world than there is with the terrestrial world.
Since Ori got to completely change the question, I feel like I should to answer it as well. If we're talking about from the 30,000 foot view, I agree with Ori. I think what drives a lot of us as scientists is discovery. And I've realized for myself, oftentimes if given my own druthers, I like to keep working on the same things, meaning focused on refining methodological techniques for sampling or using innovative data techniques for analyzing patterns better in fisheries, either spatially or temporal distributions. But I think one of the things that's been pushing me a lot more recently is to break outside of the traditional work I do. You know, being at UVI, it's really challenged me to do a lot of interdisciplinary work with partners that I had never really thought to work with, like the NRT project that I had mentioned about food, energy, water systems, Nexus. You know, that's nothing I was ever really trained on in graduate school, but I have some really great partners at the University of South Florida in their environmental engineering department who had worked with me on some previous projects and asked me to join them on this submission. And so I think that's kind of what's been driving a lot of my new focus in research is trying to bridge different interdisciplinary boundaries. I also do a lot of interesting work on broadening participation and diversity, or I guess we call it justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion work now, JEDI, which is a really fun acronym. But I've been working a lot with a sociologist at Arizona State University on projects that help us understand how to improve broadening participation and improve diversity, equity, and inclusion. And, you know, that's a completely foreign field to me at first. I never really understood how to measure changes in human understanding and human participation and those things before working with a sociologist. And so I would say pushing the boundaries on my own research and understanding into new fields and doing more interdisciplinary work has been a really interesting focus for myself now. Thanks for letting me re-answer, Julie.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ori, for
changing the question. Yeah. It's all a collaboration. I feel right. Like you guys have kind of answered this a little bit, but pie in the sky, money isn't an object. Is there one specific area that you would love to be working in or project you would love to be pursuing?
Now, instead of the 30,000 foot view, I thought I'd take, you know, much more drilled in view on this one. And Sinai could probably talk to this a lot better than I can. I just recognize that it's an issue that should be resolved, which is I'd love to find out more about the Caribbean spiny lobster. I think that we know very little about the number one fish species across the Caribbean. And when I say we know very little about it, I mean specifically between the connectivity and the larval dispersal. I mean, and again, Sinai can speak better to this than I can, but I believe that we think that it's the same population of lobsters from Brazil through the Carolinas, genetically speaking. And so, you know, we don't have a strong handle of the connectivity within that region, and we don't have a strong handle on how they settle, where they settle, why they settle. We know that they have what's called a very long pelagic larval duration, which means that they stay as larvae in the water column for a really long time. I believe it's about 2 months. So if you think about, you know, a particle in the water for 2 months, and as a larvae, they do have the ability to move. And so, you know, it really can move. It can really go to different places. And so kind of finding the source sink dynamics of the region for Caribbean spiny lobster would be fascinating to me. And, you know, I say that when you're talking about money not being an object, because, I mean, that would entail a collaboration among, you know, dozens of countries and, I mean, just tons of researchers and a lot of research hours in the field. And you'd have to kind of sample the water column for the larvae, the adults on the reef, the juvenile settlers, all that and everything in between.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same vein with Rory. I think for the U.S. Caribbean, what really interests me is, I think, two aspects of connectivity research, which is what Ori's been, you know, alluded to with spiny lobster. I think for a large amount of our fisheries in the region, they are highly dependent upon changing oceanographic circulation patterns and environmental and oceanographic conditions that we don't have a great handle on, because we need to really have a better monitoring system for, you know, both physical, biological, and chemical oceanographic properties that spans the entire Caribbean. And that spans a lot of different countries, and it makes it hard. And it's also very expensive. you know, if you want to start putting out a lot of monitoring buoys that cover this entire region, you're talking a lot of money that I think it would be hard pressed to get without some sort of large scale international collaborations, which I don't think are happening right now. Right. So IUSE, which is the Integrated Ocean Observing System, is an international effort that is working to some extent. Within the US, there is the different regional associations. So in the Caribbean, we have CARICUS. I would love to see a greatly expanded CARICUS that is monitoring all of these things that can help us inform our models. I think right now in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, we're able to get a circulation model at a level of about 1 kilometer. And in some areas down to 300 meters is the best resolution we've been able to do with the model that myself and my postdoc, Dr. Sanaljit Mukherjee, are building. But it's really limited by not having enough actual in situ data, meaning buoys that are measuring currents, velocity and direction, temperature in the region that we're trying to look for, or, you know, systems like high frequency radars like they have on the West Florida shelf that allows them to create really great modeling. So for me, that would be an area that I would like to see improved. If we could create this larger physical oceanographic monitoring presence across the entire Caribbean to help us create these really high resolution models, I think that would greatly inform our ability to understand the fisheries that are in this region. Because we have to remember that the area that the fish are inhabiting are a lot larger often than the land base that we occupy.
I think low latitudes have particular issues.
We also don't really have a good handle on how it's changing and how the environmental conditions are changing with global climate change, right? We get little glimpses, but we need long data sets and really focused efforts to better predict and model what's going to happen in the next 50 years. Those are the things that keep me up at night thinking about where our research can go.
Back in St. Pete here and hanging out at the tavern like we used to do, and everybody's got one of those in grad school, right? Having some beers one day and you're going to start a story with, "No shit, there I was." Sanai, what would your story be?
Oh God, that's a hard one. I think there are like a lot of stories that I have about interesting things that have happened to me. I don't know if I'd begin them with "oh shit," but I can tell you one about one of my first cruises out in the Gulf. I was lucky enough to work with a group that was doing these fisheries independent surveys out in the Gulf. And you know, this is, I think, the second year I had gone out with them. We were doing this tow using a methot trawl, which is this really big rectangular net that gets towed down at deeper depths so we can get midwater fishes. And I had never really done this. Most of my work was surface tows because we're looking at, I was interested in the scombrids or the tunas. And so we had another researcher. So this researcher was doing mesopelagic and bathypelagic fish, so midwater and deeper water open ocean larvae. And we'd done a couple tows with some other nets that had gotten things like the hatchet fishes and some really interesting myctophids that I had never seen before. And then he wanted to try for kind of larger adult fish. And so, you know, if you guys don't know, towing a net at a fish, which is a highly mobile animal, you know, you can catch them when they're small fish because if you tow it faster than they can swim, you'll catch it. But for some of the larger fish, for instance, you need a really big net that's kind of outside of their view. So that's why we were using something like a methot trawl. So I was so excited to like try and catch some stuff. So there's really neat fish down there. Like a cookie cutter shark was on my bucket list. I'd never actually seen one caught. And I had read about one in a fisheries magazine. And it's this, they have green eyes and they have kind of a circular mouth because what they do is they kind of swim into a fish and spin themselves in a way that allows them to cut out these little cookie cutter sized bites of fish. And that's how they feed. And so I had never seen one. And I had asked the guy, and this was one of the things he had said, he could see. But while we were doing the net, I had to go in and start readying a CTD, which is an instrument that allows us to collect water. Those of you that have done this know these things take a long time, 2 4-hour tows or depths. And I totally had missed them bringing up the methot trawl and sorting through everything. So I missed like the cookie cutter sharks and all the cool fish that they had brought on because I was inside getting other stuff done and nobody called me. And I was like, I was really mad, you know, that I hadn't gotten to see it. So I'm sitting out on the deck in the rain, stewing while we're, you know, watching the wire angle on a CTD that's going down, you know, pretty deep while all this is happening. And so, you know, at 2 a.m., we finally are bringing the CTD up and one of the bottles didn't trip down at depth. And I was just kind of in a bad mood. So I was just like, bring it up. And like, lo and behold, when we get the CTD on the surface, a cookie cutter shark was tangled in the bottle, which is what had kept it from tripping. And I got to actually see a cookie cutter shark. So I was like, oh shit, there it is. I don't even know if they got any cookie cutter sharks on the methot trawl. I just remember that I really wanted to see one. They could have been lying to me that they had got them and thrown it over.
How does a cookie cutter shark get tangled in your bottles?
Beyond me, Julie. Maybe it, like maybe there are like other fish that were swimming around it and it was like it kind of like swam into it and hit into it and got tangled in one of the cables as it was tripping. I have no idea.
That's crazy.
Was just happy we caught one.
Yeah.
Cool boring. Stuff happens in the open ocean.
It does. All kinds of crazy things happen in the open ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just enjoying the visual of Sinai stewing in the rain on the back deck there.
I will say that was when I was an early student scientist. I don't stew as much now because I'm much more understanding.
Ori, okay. Do you have a favorite memory or no shit moment?
Yeah, I'm not going to call it my favorite memory. Okay. But I think that a lot of us that work in the field have shark stories.
Mm-hmm. So.
I'll go ahead and tell you my shark story. I did my dissertation with Goliath grouper, which is a very big fish. And so I have a very big shark story. So the Goliath grouper, for our listeners who don't know, is the largest grouper in the Atlantic Ocean. Can get, historically, could get up to 8 feet long and 350 kilos, right? So these things are the size of like a Volkswagen Bug type thing. And my sampling included, Julie alluded to it earlier in the show, that my sampling included non-lethal techniques to find out a lot of things about this fish that normally you would need lethal techniques. So for example, the stomach contents. Most fish, when you want to find out what they've been eating, you cut them open, you cut their stomach open, and you pull out the stomach contents, right? Well, if you don't want to kill the fish, as was the case with the Goliath grouper, because they are endangered, we would pry the mouth open and stick your arm down into their mouth through the throat and into the stomach and pull out whatever they've been eating. And that's how we would do stomach content samples. So we had a lot of different things that we were doing non-lethally to sample these fish. And so I was part of kind of a larger project. And one of the other researchers came down from Florida State while I was doing my PhD in St. Pete and asked me to help him out on his sampling. So of course I said yes. And we were going off of St. Petersburg into the Gulf and going to shipwrecks. And because that's where they like to hang out. And we were sampling adults. And the way you got to sample these things is you throw like a dock line over the edge that has about 7 pounds of scuba weights on it, a 900 pound test and a 20-aught hook. And then you bait it with like, you know, half an amberjack or something like that. So a massive hunk of fish. So we had, you know, we went to a site, we sampled a site, we went to another site and we just weren't really hitting. We weren't getting a lot of bites. And then finally we start getting a couple bites and we get one and it comes up to the surface. We pull it up to the surface and we see that it's kind of like mangled. It's injured, clearly injured. And we have another line in the water that also hits at the same time. So the one that was in the water, though, the grouper that got it, what we call hold up, right? So groupers, when they don't want to be pulled, they'll go into a hole and they'll kind of lock themselves in there. And so when it's a Goliath grouper, they get really locked down. So the genius plan that we came up with was that me and another guy were going to go on scuba down this line. It's about 100 feet, go down this dock line, get down to the wreck, and like wrestle the fish out of the wreck. Okay. Now, I'd be lying if I said it was the first time we'd done that. So it wasn't exactly like, you know, all that unique, but anyway, so we go down the line, and what had happened was the fish had gotten loose and the hook was just stuck onto the wreck. So that's why we couldn't pull it loose. But we undo it and whatever, and we start looking around and just to do a bit of a survey on the wreck to see how many grouper were down there. And after about 20 minutes, we decide to go up. And as we start our ascent, we see a bull shark. And it's like, oh, that's cool, you know, bull shark. And so then we start going up, and we see two bull sharks, and they're kind of on the edge of the visibility. It's not like such a big deal, you know. By the time we get to our safety stop, they're starting to get a little closer and they start to circle us. Now, you know, for those of you scuba divers, I mean, sharks aren't scary unless they start doing scary stuff, and circling you is definitely one of those things that they do that's scary. So there was two sharks circling us, then there were three. Then there were four, turned into seven bull sharks circling us on our safety stop. So you can imagine you're 15 to 20 feet underwater, seven bull sharks circling you. Now, luckily I had a pole spear in my hand and my buddy also had one. And so we were back to back, right? Tanks back to back, holding these like spears out like they're gonna do anything, right? And seven sharks. So you're kind of scanning around, right? Your head's on a swivel. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know? And then all of a sudden it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And you're like, where's the other one? And you look down and he's rushing you from underneath. And so we had these bull sharks rushing us from underneath. And when they come up, you'd have to like bop them on the nose with your pole spear to get them to go away like that. So we didn't adhere to the best diving practices, and we cut our safety stop a bit short. And we get to the surface, and the boat is like 150 meters away. We're just like, you gotta be kidding me, right? So we've got our faces in the water, obviously, because there's seven bull sharks still circling us. We can't really even call for help. And I don't even remember what exactly I said, but I like popped my head up like really quick and was just like, shark, come get us, you know, something like that. And so they go and they heard us and they came to come get us. But what I found out later is they thought we just had the Goliath on a line. So they weren't like too concerned about us. So they go to start the boat, and lo and behold, the boat doesn't start. And so we're sitting there, you know, still in the water like this, being circled by the bull shark. And what happens is they finally, I think they realized what was going on. And so luckily we were down current to them. So they let out all the anchor line they could, to the point that there was one person on the front of the boat with the line in one hand and the cleat of the boat in the other hand. They get close enough to us that we swim over. I have never jumped onto a boat in full scuba gear like that, but I did that day. I just jumped right on out. Now, what had happened was that mangled Goliath, the one that had the, you know, that had been messed up from a previous encounter, was on the boat and had some sort of disease or something and was completely bleeding out. The hook had punctured its internal organs, and it was just bleeding out all over the place. So you can imagine, you got this 300-pound fish bleeding over the side of the boat. And so that's what had attracted everybody, but we had no idea, you know, we were in the water. So we get back onto the boat, and these bull sharks are hanging around in the back of the boat. And then we see there's like a school of maybe, I don't know, 50 massive barracuda. There's a bunch of jacks circling around and all the rest of it.
Everybody came to lunch.
The end of the story is a little anticlimactic. We were allowed in our permitting. It was written in that if one of the samples had died on board, we could, you know, harvest some of the other stuff that we would normally not take, like the otolith, for example. So we worked up the rest of the fish, and then the plan was, all right, let's, you know, let's take what we need, and then let's throw the carcass over, and let's get all our GoPros in the water, let's check this out and everything. So everybody had their camera, other than me, ready. My job was to flip the carcass into the water. And so we were all excited about it. And I go and I flip it into the water, it hits the water, and it sinks straight to the bottom. And all the fish are staying there on the top, circling still. We're like, okay, great, you know? And then the biggest of the bull sharks just goes straight down in a direct dive down like 100 feet, you know? And literally every other fish on the surface followed it down like that. And I bet it would have been pretty cool to see underwater. So there you go, big shark story.
Yeah, everybody's got an amazing epic story. I always love it. I love to hear everybody's epic stories.
Always pays to take a camera too. I will say, I hate being out in the field and focusing on taking pictures, but like the people that can do it well document so much more of their work than I do. And then like when you have newsletters or websites, like you always need pictures. And I'm always like, no, I never took a camera. Right. Sorry. I don't dive as much as I used to. I do a lot more ship-based work, but.
Now the tough part of the interview is over and it's down to my final questions. We always like to start real simple here on the podcast with what is your favorite fish, Ori?
Goliath grouper, gotta be.
Sinai?
I would say adult stage. I've gotten really into mutton snapper lately, and then
they're tasty.
From a fishing standpoint, they are delicious. But from a work standpoint, I love leptocephalus larvae. I really love catching those in the net. They're just really interesting. So they span a bunch of different species. It can be from a tarpon, bonefish, certain eels, but I find those beautiful.
And probably both of you are living in places where most people would consider their dream location, but do you have a dream job or location?
I mean, I think I'm in my dream location. I always wanted to come back to the USVI. I love it here. I would say dream job. I don't know. I love what I do. I think if all of my efforts could be just on research that I wanted to go after, you know, like doing just only fisheries and had a lot of the administrative side of things taken away, that would be a dream job. Or maybe just doing like aquaculture here in the VI. But I really am happy with what I do in a lot of respects.
Yeah, I'm with Sinai. I love where I live. I love what I do. I think that there's a big part of me that always wants to travel more and see new places. And I think that in my underwater career, I've seen a lot of really cool places. But I think one place that's, you know, noticeably missing is the Coral Triangle. I'd really like to kind of go visit that area of the world. See some of the old World War II stuff, you know, like the Chuck Lagoon in the South Pacific. I mean, for those of you who don't know, they had a World War II battle there and then never cleaned it up. So it's like, you know, downed airplanes and I don't know if there's aircraft carriers, but there's battleships and all sorts of stuff just that was encrusted by the reef over the decades, you know. And from what I understand, it's just an amazing place. The other thing is I definitely, and this is not for work, but in terms of a dream dive that I'm dying to do is hanging out with the humpbacks in Silver Bank off of the Dominican Republic. And apparently it's a very, from what I understand, there's a very long waiting list and it's very expensive to go to do. And there's a very limited amount of boats that they allow in there to do that. But you basically get to go scuba diving with humpback calves and their mothers. And it's from all accounts, from what I've heard, people who've done it just say it's mind-blowing amazing.
Wow, that does sound amazing. Put that on my bucket list too. and our final question, if there was one point or principle you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be? Sinai?
I'd just say how useful getting fisheries independent data into fisheries decision support systems can be. You know, it's expensive and time consuming, but it really opens up a lot more information on understanding more about the fishery, particularly if you're looking at early life history. I know this is a plug for the type of work I do, but it really can highlight a lot more about the population dynamics from the early life history stages, which are, we don't know as much as we like to think we know about.
Ori, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say, you know, one thing that I don't think is understood well enough is that, you know, we have the technology, we have the know-how, we have, you know, we know how to manage fisheries in a lot of circumstances. And when you look to examples of places who do it well, you can see this, that, you know, there are places that manage their fisheries very well and very sustainably. What's missing, in my opinion, is the will, the willpower, the public outcry for this sort of thing. And I mean, like I said, you look at a place like Iceland, and they were in a real crisis in the 70s with their fisheries. And the difference is that their economy was largely based on the success of their fishery. And so the fishermen went to the scientists and said, hey, we need to figure this out together. And together they went to the government, who enacted laws, and they all made it work together. And now Iceland has one of the most successful fisheries in the world, from what I understand. And so, you know, we have the know-how. We know how to do it. We just have to have the willpower.
Julie, can I just add to that too? I think, you know, one of the things that we're noticing as scientists is we're going through this era where we are losing biodiversity, both terrestrial and in the world's oceans, at an alarming rate. And so I think one of the things that I've noticed in like my own work is just how interconnected the work that we do within fisheries, from managing populations, is to understanding the patterns and changes in biodiversity. And so I think, you know, a lot of what Ori and I do in trying to create these ecosystems-based fisheries management plans for regions is to merge both of those worlds in a lot of ways. So I think trying to find ways of increasing the ability to do both this biodiversity monitoring as well as single species or ecosystems-based fisheries monitoring, so that we are pooling resources rather than pulling away from each other, I think is a really important thing to think about in the future of fisheries work and science going forward.
Well, thank you both again for agreeing to come on the show. If people want to get in touch with you online, where's one place that they could find you, Sinai?
They can go to our UVI website and find me there, or they can go to the Virgin Islands EPSCoR program website, which is where we describe a lot of our new project, which is the Ridge to Reef project that we're doing for the Virgin Islands EPSCoR program. I do most of my work through them. So those would be two places where they can catch me. Or you can always just shoot me an email once you find me on our faculty directory at the University of the Virgin Islands.
Ori, is there any place people could look for you?
Yeah, I'm on a couple social media sites, including LinkedIn, Twitter. My Twitter handle is @OTZADIK, so that's OTZADIK. Absolutely. Anybody listening, feel free to shoot me a line and happy to respond, happy to chat.
Thank you to everybody for listening to the 113th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter @FishVecchio. The podcast is @FisheriesPod. We're on Facebook and Instagram, a Fisheries Podcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. Don't forget to head on over to our Patreon page or Teespring store to support the podcast. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, we have the tools. We just need the will.
Way to make me look like a caveman there.